Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everyone thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockrell.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. This is our third and final look at the magical date of August the 23rd and what it means in the mystical world of the Beatles. We've already proven many things, haven't we? It's first week in Hamburg, it's middle of the cavern, it's John's wedding anniversary with Cynthia, it's the She Loves You Day, it's the Hollywood Bowl Day, it's many things to many people, and it's Drugs Day.
And 1966, it's Tuesday.
1966, it's a Tuesday.
Again.
Well, that's how time works. And they are playing Shea Stadium for the second time. Amusingly, in Anthology, some of them only remember playing it one time.
Yes. This is the Shea Stadium show that no one talks about.
Yes, because it is different to the first Shea Stadium show. So that's a hard thing to say. Shea Stadium show. That's my actor's routine for the morning time. The first appearance had been on the 15th of August, 1965. A huge success, famously recorded for a television special. It was a world record appearance at the time.
World record attendance figures, world record gross revenue. So they actually, the box office was $304,000, of which the Beatles pocketed $160,000.
That's a lot of thousands of dollars.
That is a lot of thousands of dollars.
And this was famously promoted by Sid Bernstein, who comes back into the Beatles story in the 70s, trying to get them to reform and offering them millions of dollars to reform. You know, it's a big deal. It is a massive stadium that they are playing. The field hasn't got any spectators on. Everyone's just sitting up in the stands, and the Beatles are playing like four small figures in the middle of everything.
It's a very strange setup.
It's a very strange setup. But again, and you know, we touch upon this, the Beatles are going into areas that people have never been before. So trying to answer the question of if there is a demand for tickets, where do you play? So these are the first stadium gigs, and they are defining a new way of entertainment.
Yeah, if they did it today, the Golden Circle would be on the field. Yeah. And you have to pay $1,000 to...
Exactly, there'd be this new variable price ticketing system and all the rest, just like Bruce Springsteen is famously doing. But showbiz is fickle, and 1 year after their first appearance at Shea Stadium, they are doing their second appearance at Shea Stadium, and it's only roughly at about 80% capacity. There's 11,000 of the 55,000 plus tickets that are for sale. They are unsold, and they've been on the market for 2 months. And this is kind of news that the Beatles are not selling out anymore.
Is the popularity waning?
Is it waning, do you think?
Is it waning? Well, the Newsweek headline, the week of the show was Blues for the Beatles, and they said their music, now baroque and folk, has cooled off many who used to pack the palladiums. I object to the use of the word palladiums.
Oh, the Latin should be...
Palladia.
Of course.
Of course.
The Beatles tickets are about $5 if you want to go see the Beatles in 1966. But due to, you know, showbiz leverage, they make more money from the less sold out gig in 66 than they do from 65's gig.
Good old Brian.
Yes, they get 65% of the gross takings of $292,000, which makes them pocket $189,000, back when a dollar against the pound gave you lots of pounds.
Give you lots of pounds.
Lots and lots of pounds. It's their final New York appearance, and it's also part of that 66 tour, which is hard work for the Beatles.
Yeah, so the 66 tour in the States and in Canada, there are 19 performances, and the whole outing is beset by problems, not least of which is the Bigger Than Jesus controversy. But also the band just generally have become tired of performing. John says you could never hear what we were doing. It would just become a sort of happening, like Shea Stadium was a happening. You couldn't hear any music at all. That got boring, and that's why we stopped it. And the safety of the band, the security issues. So in the middle of the performance, some fans do break through the barriers, but they're held back. But there's just an unsettling feeling, I think, to this whole tour.
Yes, it kind of starts with the initial kind of world tour where they're in the Philippines and they're kind of having trouble over there. By the time they get to the US leg of the 66 tour and, you know, Revolver is hitting the stores, you know, the Bigger Than Jesus is probably the biggest controversy that they are facing at that time.
Yes, and you know, this extends. Whenever they first arrived, they're in Chicago, and John makes an apology, and that's a very famous sort of piece of footage which is colorized for the 8 days a week, where he supposedly is in tears before he goes out to make this apology. He is apologetic, and the band are sort of gathered sitting around him, and they're quite supportive. By the time they get to New York City, his mood has changed, and the band's mood has changed. And so this abject apology takes place in Chicago. In New York, John says, well, there are more people in America, so there are more bigots. And Paul says, we don't care about those people who don't like us because of the statement. So you can see over the course of the tour, their attitude about this has changed. People are burning records. People were buying records just to burn them, and sales skyrocketed.
They were happy with that. And, this is the Beatles inventing that most loathsome of phrases, cancel culture.
Yes.
Where people are deciding, yes, we're going to cancel the Beatles because they're bigger than Jesus.
It's like that song by Prefab Sprout. We were quoted out of context. It was great.
And it is the belligerence they have in the wake of that statement, where they are kind of saying, you know, John's doing that, you know, I'm not saying we're better than Jesus or God as a thing or whatever it is. And it's not that they don't care, but it's that kind of Mark Lewisohn thing where they're not going to be dishonest in a way. You know, they're going to try and pursue the truth of what they meant. And, you know, what they did mean was that they meant more to many young people than religion.
Yeah.
And people followed them like a religion.
And people followed them. And that there was a sort of a gap there. And he sort of makes the point, well, you know, I could have said television or I could have said anything.
Yeah.
But it is, you can see the band coming to the end of their tether.
Yes.
They're fed up. They don't want to do this. And they've made the apology at the beginning of the tour in Chicago, but it's still going on. And they take a much more aggressive, less apologetic line as the tour goes on. And by the end of the tour, as we know, they've resolved they're not going to do it again. The Shea Stadium, I don't think there's any sense that they're thinking we're commercially on the wane. Mm. They just don't want to do it.
And they're also a few years ahead of the curve. You know, it's going to take another maybe 3 to 5 years for the notion of large arena, stadium gigs, sound systems, all that stuff to catch up. So famously, you know, by the time you get to 69, you know, you have festival sound and festival speakers and the Rolling Stones tour and all the rest. They're trying to plug into that space. So they're trying to do something that hasn't been done before. And it's just, you know, it's not a good experience for them emotionally. And it's not really passing their quality control.
It isn't. And you mentioned about people not really remembering, you know, the second gig. Neil Aspinall does talk about this in Anthology, and he says when they played Shea Stadium again, for me, it blended in with the first one, though it was said there were slightly fewer people than there were the year before. For some reason, I missed the police van that was taking us. I'd gone back for something, and before I could get in the van, they slammed the doors and off they went. I was left at the hotel, so I got a cab, but that broke down in Harlem. Another cab took me to the stadium. Thousands of people, and I thought, oh God, are they really going to let me in? I'm just going to knock on the door and say, hey, I'm with the Beatles. And then I saw the four of them banging out the window, and they saw me wandering around the car park, and it was like magic, and they were shouting, there he is, let him in, let him in. So chaos, you know, he is their kind of key man on the tour, and it's just absolute chaos. And then when the gig is over, they just get in a plane and they fly to LA. And interestingly, one of the people on the plane with him is this guy, Art Unger, of Datebook. And Datebook is the magazine in which the Bigger Than Jesus statement is published. And I thought it's interesting that they're not holding it against him.
Yes.
You know, he is there. And Datebook is a slightly odd publication. I always assumed that this was, you know, it was the statement was originally made on a Maureen Cleave article, and it was a very serious piece, and then it was sort of transposed into a sort of teen magazine, and that was what the issue was. But Datebook is actually a very progressive magazine and was sort of dealing with things like drug culture, and Art Unger deliberately picked that headline, not as a sort of sensationalist thing, but because it was making a serious point that there is a a void, a kind of vacuum, and that religion is no longer filling that. And people, so he I think was approaching it from that point of view, and he apologized to them, but I think they respected him for what he was doing and what his intention was. What I hadn't realized was that Datebook was actually founded by Art Unger and a chap called Danny Fields.
Oh yeah,
Danny Fields was a very good friend of became a very good friend of Linda McCartney's. Wrote a very good bio on Linda McCartney, but he also managed various bands, including Iggy and the Stooges, MC5, and the Ramones, who took their name from Paul Ramone, and wrote a song called Danny Says about Danny Fields.
It's all connected. Is that what you want me to say?
That's what I want you to say.
Grand. That is amazing. What you do notice when we look at this kind of August the 23rd prism is you notice that there is a pattern here where they're in this end of August period. And this is the third year in a row where they are in the midst of touring the US and they're heading off to the West Coast. So for a band who didn't like to repeat themselves or do the same thing, this is the third August where they're kind of in the same pattern. So they must have also been aware of that, trying to, you know, 66 is all about breaking the patterns. You know, first of all, they break the movie patterns. So they don't do the third movie. And now they're trying to break the touring pattern. It's obviously the portal between, you know, the first half and that kind of second half. And so you kind of see that this is the third August that they're doing this.
Yeah. So this is them just disrupting that pattern. The August blues.
The August blues. So let's move a year ahead. The 23rd of August, 1967, a Wednesday. They are not on tour. They are not in LA. They are not in a house. They are recording, but they are not in Abbey Road.
Where be they?
They be in Chapel Recording Studios, London. And they are recording Your Mother Should Know.
Should she?
Mm. And again,
it's your favourite song.
Well, no. We talk about how much changes within a week. And this is Wednesday, the 23rd of August. And this is quite another transformative week in the Beatles. So, you know, Paul apparently had been to Chapel Studios before for Chris Barber sessions. Is that right?
That's right. July the 20th to play the piano and ad-lib vocals on his rendition of Cat Call, which you may know as Cat's Walk. So this is an instrumental tune being kicking around. This is one of the 200 songs that they had lying around from the late 50s, early 60s. And it's a Chris Barber, you know, trad. It's trad, dad.
Yeah.
Skiffle.
And once the Beatles are brought back here for Your Mother Should Know, and this is a track we kind of talked about. Your Mother Should Know was in the running for the R World performance.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
How great would that have been?
Terrible.
Yeah.
But it kind of, you know, it's in this notion of, well, it's a big old sing-along. It's kind of a bland, inoffensive kind of thing.
Bland, inoffensive. It's
offensive.
Well, no. It's a call for cross-generational harmony, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Paul, in many years from now, says, I dreamt up Your Mother Should Know as a production number, Paul explains. And, you know, we can sing one or two songs for real. I wrote it in Cavendish Avenue on the harmonium I have in the dining room here. My Auntie Jin, her of Let Him In, and Uncle Harry and a couple of relatives were staying and they were in the living room across the hall. So I went to the dining room and spent a few hours with the door open and them listening. Like, shut the door.
No, I just think that is such a... Go and spend time with you. You've got your house guests. You know, I'm just going to go and sit over here and play the harmonium.
Yeah.
You know who else plays the harmonium? Allen Ginsberg.
He's the harmonium king.
He is the harmonium king. But that is... I have a little note. Is this odd? Where it says, I just went to the dining room and spent a few hours with the door open playing the harmonium with them listening. I bet you they weren't listening at all. They're probably trying to watch the football or something.
They probably went down the road, came back in. Oh, that was great, Paul.
Down the pub.
Really enjoyed that. I didn't realise that it came, that there's a title, the song comes from A Taste of Honey. The film, not the song, the 1961 film. They are recording in Chapel Studios and, you know, they kind of start, they've already done some takes from the previous day. So they're doing kind of
one of those reduction takes
so they can put on overdubs of vocals and backing vocals. But the reason that this session is significant is that Brian Epstein is here.
It's a key moment in the movie.
It is a key moment in the movie because this is the last time they will see Brian alive.
Yes.
And he wasn't always at this point calling into every single session. So it's poignant that he turns up at this session.
Yes. We talked in season six about, you know, the difficulties that he was having in his personal life, in his business life. The studio was not his natural environment. And it is tempting, you know, this isn't taking place in Abbey Road. So it's not even in the Beatles' usual environment.
Yeah.
And yet he turns up. And what is particularly haunting, and again, if you wrote this in the script, somebody might be saying, well, this is a bit overkill. But we have a description. John Timperley, the engineer, he said, Brian came in to hear the playbacks looking extremely down and in a bad mood. He just stood at the back of the room listening, not saying much. Mm. And there's a kind of wistful air to that, that he just is watching them recording this song. And it's a song, you know, we talked before about Brian is not their generation. He is a different generation.
Yep.
They're playing this song, which Paul talks about being, you know, a plea for generations to work together, or we should sort of... And it's an odd, very poignant soundtrack to Brian just standing, watching. And it's a very visual thing. You can see that playing out in your mind.
Yeah, and it's, you know, he wouldn't contribute to these recording sessions, but he still felt it necessary to turn up on occasion and talk to them. And this is the outtake version of Your Mother Should Know. It doesn't even go to completion. This is the version that turns up on Anthology 2. But this is Wednesday, August the 23rd. This is the week that we've discussed before where the Beatles plug into the Maharishi.
Yeah. So again, it's a week where everything will change. And they see Brian for the last time. And as he sort of both literally and metaphorically exits,
yeah,
the Maharishi is entering.
Yes. Yeah, so this is a Wednesday session, and it is the following weekend that they go on the trip to Bangor to see the Maharishi. So it's all very closely connected. They go into the week as one type of band, and they exit the week as a completely different type of band.
Yeah. They, you know, we've talked before about, you know, they meet the Maharishi, they make a decision, they cancel a recording session to go down to Bangor. They renounce drugs.
Yeah.
You know, they say, but that's not the answer, and we're not going to do that. And the next day, they find out that Brian has died.
Yeah.
And as you say, they're a completely different band at the end of the weekend.
Yeah, so it's a busy week. August the 23rd, 67, they are recording Your Mother Should Know. Brian is there for the last time. August the 24th, they meet the Maharishi for the first time. And August the 25th, they go to Bangor. So a transformative period of time. It's the end of a very significant period of their lives on August the 23rd, 1967.
All change.
We then move forward to 1968. And things are quite different. The Beatles have had a break. Well, maybe they haven't, but we're going to take a break now anyway.
End of part one. Intermission.
Jetzt bei der Telekom.
What the world needs now.
Das neue Samsung Galaxy S26 Ultra mit Galaxy AI. Die einfache Art, AI zu erleben. Spare jetzt über 500 Euro und sogar noch mehr, wenn du dein altes Handy bei uns abgibst. Im besten Netz. Nur bei der Telekom.
La, 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 la.
End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. We are in the final stretches of August the 23rd being the greatest day in Beatle history. It is 1968. It is Friday, August the 23rd. Another leap year has passed. And this is the Beatles recording and mixing back in the USSR. But this is the first session ever by a group that would somewhat colloquially be known as the Threetles. Because what has happened?
Is it? Is it though?
Well, it's a
is
form it of Threetles.
Is it?
It's not the Threetles we came to know in the 90s had a different
we
lineup.
We came to know and love. We came to know and love. Well,
the name that no one loved more.
Yeah, Threetles. Yes. Two possible earlier Threetles.
Okay, earlier Threetles.
Okay, well, we know that She Said, She Said.
Yes.
Where Paul doesn't play the bass. except perhaps he does play the bass.
Which we've talked about, yeah. And which is in the box set as Paul playing the bass on She Said, She
yes,
Said.
Yes, and about which we had to have a steward's inquiry at the
recent Dublin Beatles Fest.
But, you know, that's why you have a lawyer on the team. But somebody said to me as well, not a second time.
Yep.
Does George play on that?
Hmm.
Now, I'd never heard this before, but apparently there is speculation that you know, George doesn't actually play on that song. So I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there.
Well, Not a Second Time, which is recorded in September 63 and appears on With the Beatles.
Yeah.
George is officially listed as being on acoustic guitar,
and Ian MacDonald talks about it, but there is some speculation.
And where would that speculation be? The internet, I suppose.
The internet. I read it on the internet, so it must be true.
So it must have happened.
It must have happened.
We've had Wantle songs where there's only one Beatle. There's Yesterday. That's a Wantle song.
Is that a thing?
I think a Wantle.
A Wantle.
There are Tootle songs.
Someone else in the room.
That's the audience. And we always have an audience. They've just never laughed before. This is the three Beatles, because the previous night Ringo famously quit the band.
He does.
That most angry of men, Ringo
yes.
Starr.
Slow to anger, fast to walk.
So where should we go? Back in the USSR or Ringo? Which avenue to go down
what
first?
What do you think? Let's go down the Ringo Avenue.
The Ringo Avenue. Ringo seems to, you know, have been taken for granted. The patience of Job. He is described by Ron Richards as always sitting in the reception area of Abbey Road, waiting, just sitting there or reading a newspaper. He used to sit there for hours waiting for the others to turn up.
That's just rude.
It is kind of rude.
You know, we're going to convene a session, but we're just not going to be there for several hours.
Yeah.
You just sit there.
And famously, Ringo says, you know, he learned how to play chess on Sergeant Pepper because he was so hanging around and bored.
I think it's the way... It's the new way of recording.
Yes.
So about overdubbing and working in the studio. And, you know, so he does his drum part. And then he's kind of surplus to requirements because they've got the basic rhythm track is usually the first thing that they put down. One of the things that, you know, we mentioned when we talked about the previous 23rd of August and Art Unger being on the flight to LA with them after the Shea Stadium, the second Shea Stadium gig. He has a very long interview with Ringo on that plane, and Ringo talks there about the possibility of them going their separate ways and alludes to the fact that it's going to be difficult for him. You know, he's the drummer. He doesn't write songs. He talks about the fact that he doesn't have as much money as the others because of the songwriting. And he is the one that you would think would be the last to leave.
Mm.
If you were looking at it purely from the point of view of, well, what's he going to do? Is he going to be able to forge a career on his own? But yet he's the one that cracks. So you've got to think, what happened?
Well, yeah. And Ringo, from the perspective of August the 23rd, 66, he knows that John's going off to make a movie and George's going to travel to India and Paul is going to do a soundtrack, and he might be trying to wonder what's going to happen next if they're saying we're not going on the road anymore. He can question what his purpose is. But, you know, by the time we get to 1968, they have kind of rewritten the rule books for, as you say, how to use a recording studio. Mm. Sessions generally start at 7 p.m. and they are keeping rock star hours where they will, you know, start at 7 p.m. and kind of roll through till 4, 5 or 6 in the morning. And people just have to keep up with them. And so the previous day, August the 22nd, you know, they're due to begin at 7 p.m. and chances are they arrived late. And there's apparently just some tension in the air.
Yes. So various people have commented on this. So there was an engineer, Peter Vince. He says things were getting very strained on Beatles sessions by this time. The engineers would be asked to leave. They, the Beatles, would say, go off for a meal or go off for a drink. And you'd know they were having heavy discussions and didn't want anyone around. And this is also, famously, this is the album. These are the sessions where George Martin absents himself.
Yeah.
Chris Thomas comes in. Jeff Emmerich exits. So the whole thing seems quite fraught, despite the rewriting or the reappraisal that came with the White Album box, and everybody's very jolly and it was marvellous and
yeah.
Everybody's getting old famously. And you know, with the White Album reissue, they did sort of gloss over the fact that one of them actually left.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And it seems that Paul was, and this will sound familiar to anyone who's watched Get Back, Paul was trying to get a particular drum pattern across to Ringo. And, you know, you think of Beatles history, Ringo doesn't really need to be told much. He's got his own fantastic drum patterns, you know.
Well, yeah.
But Paul is apparently, a la George in Get Back, trying to indicate some kind of drum pattern he wants, because this is the start of recording for Back in the USSR.
Yes, I think this is it. So supposedly Paul actually gets behind the drum kit and is sort of demonstrating, you know, just hit this one and then hit that one. And then Ringo sort of, again, similar to the George in Get Back, I'll just be leaving now.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost a kind of something is building up, and then it's a spur of the moment decision. It's like, well, that's it. I'm off.
Mm.
And, you know, Ringo has said, he's quite tactful in the way that Ringo
is.
Paul is the greatest bass guitarist in the world, but he's also very determined. He goes on and on to see if he can get his own way. And Ken Scott, who was the engineer on the session, says, I remember Ringo being uptight about something. I don't remember what. It's very diplomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing, I was told that he'd quit the band. And Ringo said, I felt two things. I felt I wasn't playing great, and the other three were really happy, and I was an outsider. So, you know, I came to this decision, fuck it, I'm leaving.
Yes, I do like, Ringo said many years later, every time I went for a cup of tea, Paul was on the drums, which I think is quite funny. But Paul in 1986, you know, reflects on it because it's, you know, an important kind of moment in the Beatles. It's the first time any Beatle walks out.
Yeah.
Okay, we can talk about she said some other time.
That seems to just be a, you know, you throw toys out of the pram and you go home. But there's no question, no suggestion in 1966 that Paul is leaving the band. It's just that, you know, he's leaving the session.
Yep. But Paul kind of in 1986 says, you know, I'm sure it pissed Ringo off when he couldn't quite get the drums to Back in the USSR, and I sat in. Ouch. On his way to being a great songwriter type vibes there.
Yep.
It's very weird to know that you can do a thing someone else is having trouble with.
This is the point at which you have to say to Paul, stop talking,
Paul. If you go down and do it, just bluff through it, you think, what the hell, at least I'm helping. No, you're not. Then the paranoia comes in, but I'm going to show him up. I was very sensitive to that. No, you weren't.
I think that's the problem. That is the problem.
It's a bit like saying, I'm so sensitive to this thing that is very annoying and I'm going to keep doing it. Yeah, it's not a great excuse.
One thing that did occur to me when Ringo was saying, you know, every time I went for a cup of tea, he was on the drums. If you remember 1974, when Paul turns up for that A Toot and a Snore jam session, and Ringo is his drum, it's Ringo's drums.
And Paul gets behind
the drums, and then Ringo isn't there but comes in the next day. And he said he knew that Paul had been on the drums. He said, like, who's, because he had adjusted the drums, he changed the drums, and it was set up in a slightly different way. So, yeah, he's got form.
So, you know, when they go in on August the 23rd, 1968, it is without Ringo. Mm-hmm. It is the second day I'm back in the USSR, and they kind of produce a vibe, as Ken Scott says, you know, Ringo's not here today kind of thing, and they just carried on as usual. So, you know, according to Ken, Paul knew what he wanted on the drums. He played them himself, with George playing a chopping pattern on electric guitar to accentuate the snare beats of the drums. John sort of recounts playing bass on this. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I think he does play bass, but that was wiped.
Yeah.
And this is what's interesting, because, you know, the popular lore is Ringo left, so Paul just got behind the drums and he played the drums. But actually, it's a sort of a composite drum part. So John plays the drums, George plays the drums.
George hits a snare at some point.
So it's a sort of composite thing. And it's a bit like that, you know, is it Paul, is it Ringo on Dear Prudence? The answer is, I think it's both of them.
Yeah.
So Ringo is also absent for that, but perhaps he's overdubbing something when he comes back. So I think, and similarly, she said, Paul isn't there, he's left the session, but actually there is something he has done which is still on the track. So the overdubbing at this point sort of blurs the lines.
Yeah, it's amazing that back in the USSR is such a tight rockin' song, considering it's quite Frankensteined and quite precariously put together. And obviously it comes on to open the album, so it's that good.
It's that good. And, you know, Mark Lewisohn refers to it as one of their tightest and best recorded rock songs ever. And I think that's absolutely right. And they're working... they're working in adverse conditions. They've lost their drummer.
Yeah. Ken Scott again says, they did back in the USSR what I seem to recall was a composite drum track of bits and pieces, probably with all the other three playing drums. And there are drum parts that we can hear being played while Paul is playing instruments on the tape. And some of the overdubs you can hear on the White Album Super Deluxe Edition set, where you hear George practicing snare drums and tambourine sounds and all of that.
Yeah, and so Lewisohn says the song was also a composite recording in other ways, with three bass guitar parts played by John, Paul and George respectively, and both Paul and George playing lead guitar. So it brings the other three together.
Mm. And so that's what they do on August the 23rd, is that they make this kind of composite patchwork recording of Back in the USSR, complete it, and they just get a mono mix done straight away.
Yeah, very fast. And that's the mono mix is done on the day, and they mix in the sound of the jet engine, and there you go. It's done.
It's a Viscount turboprop airliner, folks, in case you want to...
Did you have an app that tells you that?
I do not have an app that tells me the sound of a jet.
Well, obviously you had an
app. I had my bird sound app.
You had your bird sound app that told you it was actually a blackbird.
It's actually a blackbird on Blackbird, folks. So it was quite productive, the session, and it goes on till 3 a.m. So I guess at that point it's August the 24th. We're not really interested anymore.
And is Ringo... When does Ringo get on a plane to Sardinia? He's on Peter Sellers' yacht at this point.
He goes off onto Peter Sellers' yacht and he learns about octopi gardens.
Octopi gardens.
Octopi gardens.
Yeah, I should really object to that, shouldn't I?
Well, it's possessive, so you...
So you're all right.
Well, octopus, it depends. I haven't checked where the apostrophe is.
Is it a single? It's a single... It's the garden of a single octopus.
Oh, man, that needs a lot of thought. Back in the USSR, we should talk a little bit about that song itself, because, it was written by Mike Love, wasn't it?
It was written by Mike Love, yeah. That's absolutely...
He's like the American Donovan.
He is the American Donovan.
Yes.
That's unfair.
That's unfair. That's very unfair.
Very unfair to Donovan. We take that back if we don't take it out.
But it's a song that goes back to the Indian period.
Yes.
When they were with the Maharishi, and Mike Love is in the arena.
He has a birthday. Mm. And they make up a song and called Spiritual Regeneration, which is a kind of Beach Boys-y pastiche. And one of the things that I was... I know I'm disappointed with everything that comes out in these box sets. But one of the things I was disappointed in the White Album box set is that Spiritual Regeneration, there is a very good bootleg recording, did not come out, because I think it's interesting to see that song, then the Esher demo, then the finished version of Back in the USSR. And you can see it's a very clear... Paul, you can almost hear the thought process where they're kind of... doing something Beach Boys-y for Mike Love's birthday, and then this clearly puts a notion in his head, and it develops through Esher to the finished track. But yeah, it was Mike Love that came up with most of the lyrics, I think, according to Mike Love.
Well, it is a song that you kind of forget how funny it is. Like it really is a bit of a...
It's hilarious.
It is hilarious, but it is a bit of a sly dig at the Beach Boys.
It's very much a sly dig at the Beach Boys. I mean, it highlights the fact that the Beach Boys were ripping off Chuck Berry.
Yes.
It's making fun of the Beach Boys' harmonies. But the harmonies, the vocals are brilliantly done.
Yeah.
And it has, I think, one of Paul's best lines, which is, "George was always on my mind," which is a Ray Charles song. That's a brilliant throwback.
So Mike Love says, this is a quote from Mike Love. You can decide to put some salt with it or not. "I was sitting at the breakfast table and McCartney came down with his acoustic guitar and was playing Back in the USSR. And I told him that what you ought to do is talk about the girls all around Russia, the Ukraine, and Georgia. He was plenty creative, not to need any lyrical help from me, but I gave him the idea for that little section. And as we get to 2022 and 2023, it is not in Paul's set list anymore.
No. Why is that?
Well, it would be to do with Russia and the Ukraine and the USSR as a conceptual entity.
I live in a Beatles bubble. I don't pay any attention to
it. You should check out this thing events. Called The News. It's great.
What we should do is get Donovan and Mike Love. Mm-hmm. Garfunkel, Messina, put them all together as a band. I think that'd be good.
And John Oates.
John Oates
as well. And Back in the USSR has its roots in the I'm Backing Britain campaign, which I feel we've
talked... You keep mentioning that. I just like the idea.
I love the I'm Backing Britain campaign. It just makes me laugh so much.
I am going to edit this and just have some kind of mix of you just going... I'm Jason Cardi. I'm backing Britain.
Well, you know, it was a campaign for people to be more patriotic and to work free hours to back Britain. It's everything old is new again.
This is a throwback to in the very first episode where you were saying what made the Beatles successful was they slept under a Union Jack.
Yes. Is there anything the Union Jack hasn't given us?
I admire your commitment to Britain.
Oh, God. So that's Back in the USSR, August the 23rd, 1968. Ringo has quit the band. Ringo has gone missing. But again, Beatle weeks are very crazy. You know, it's the same week where John and Yoko appear on Frost on Saturday on August the 24th. And a certain single called Hey Jude comes out, certainly in the US, on the 26th. So... It's all go. It's all go. And of course, in 1968, it's John's sixth wedding anniversary, but they are separated. So it's...
Poor Cynthia. That hadn't struck me.
Yeah.
When we were with the all this was happening around the time of their sixth wedding anniversary.
Yeah. There you go.
That's a downer.
Sorry, August the 23rd. So we wrap it up on August the 23rd, 1969. And in some ways... August the 23rd, 1969 is the first day of the rest of their lives, because the last time the four Beatles together undertake a professional commitment is on August the 22nd, 1969, when they gather for a day of photo shoots. And it is another week, again, where they start the week as one band together. It is a Saturday, August the 23rd, 69. They are working in Abbey Road at the start of the week. And by the end of the week, they will never be together again.
It's another downer.
These
episodes started so well.
Spoiler alert,
They split up. Yeah, so this is the Ethan Russell and Monty Fresco. That's a great name.
That's a fantastic name. This is the last Beatles photo session, a very famous session that I'm assuming anybody listening to this show would be aware of. It's their final photo shoot, and it's based out in Titmuss Park, John's new house.
And there's a donkey, and there's fields of wheat, and weird headgear, and
Beatle wives,
and it is very strange that is the last time they are together, because the point of that is we're having a photo shoot. You know, we're all here, we're a band. But you can tell, I mean, you can feel the tension in those photographs. But I like the idea that, you know, the next day is the first day of the rest of the lives. There's obviously, you know, we're well into the Schrodinger's Beatles era, and are they together? Have they split up?
It's when probably the first day of Schrodinger's Beatles is the 23rd of August, 1969.
Why didn't we put that? We should have started with that. It is. Yeah, this is probably the first day when, you know, that they have a communal photo shoot, and then they'll never be together again. And no one, not even themselves, are really very sure.
Yeah.
Are we together? Are we splitting up?
Well, nobody says anything. Nobody knows, that there's vague plans to, you know, what has to happen is that Abbey Road has to come out.
Yeah.
The last time they're in Abbey Road as a studio is on August the 20th that week. So they're doing the final mixing and editing for I Want You, She's So Heavy. They're slashing off the final chord. They're meeting up 2 days later for this photo shoot. And as we said, they're kind of very famous photos. And the website BeatlesBible.com has a lovely chronology of what it feels are the order of
the sequence.
The sequence of events. Because a lot of people feel that the last photo that the Beatles ever took was of them yes, waving at the table, and it's actually them standing up on the balcony outside. And, you know, August the 23rd, 1962, was the first professional photo shoot with Ringo. So there is a synchronicity. Or sorry, August the 22nd, 1962, was the first photo shoot with Ringo. So, and it's the day of, you know, of Ringo being in the band. So, you know, there's a synchronicity that this is kind of how they end.
Yes, and we're taking it as gospel that that is the last time they were together. But
well,
Chris O'Dell.
We now cut to Chris O'Dell.
Yeah.
This is the query about Patty Boyd Harrison's 1970s birthday party.
Yes, so St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March, 1970. Chris O'Dell talks about, you know, this is a sort of housewarming for Friar Park. It's much like Sittenhurst on the day of the photograph. It's, you know, it's not finished.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether the illegal lake is in Tittenhurst on the day of the photo shoot, but
it is not.
It is not.
The John and Yoko, they've only owned Tittenhurst Park a few weeks at this point. So it's always very pretentious that the Imagine House is where the Beatles last congregate. Well, but unless it's Friar Park
on
March the 17th, 1970.
So Chris O'Dell, who is a sort of, you know, central figure in Apple in the sense that she's sort of personally friendly with Patty Harrison, with George. She's working in Apple, very close to Derek Taylor. She recounts the fact that there is a birthday party slash housewarming party at Friar Park, 17th of March, 1970. And she will say that all four of the Beatles are there. I don't know whether that's true or not. March, you know, 17th of March predates, you know, at least one or possibly two of the things we identified as the Liberty Bell days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's thrown a brick through anybody's window at this stage. Letters have not been delivered at this stage. Arguments have not been had. But it seems unlikely. If they were all there, were they all in the same room at the same time?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so again, we should get Chris O'Dell or Patty Harrison, Patty Boyd, we should say, who's got a very good book out, but no photographs I've checked of the four Beatles at the house in 1970.
But as you say, on, you know, Saturday, August 23rd, 1969, it being the first day of the rest of their lives slash the first day of Schrodinger Beatles, they do not know what is going to happen next. And Abbey Road is still a few weeks from coming out. But again, this notion of Beatle lives being busy, it is, you know, there's still some, you know, Beatle recording sessions in the future. But on the 28th of August, Paul becomes a dad. Mary McCartney is born. And the other three Beatles are hanging around without Paul, going off to see Bob Dylan at the Isle of Wight.
Yeah. You think if the baby had been due, you know, 2 weeks later, perhaps the Isle of Wight concert would have been the last time the Beatles were all together, because presumably Paul would have gone.
I guess so. I don't see why he wouldn't have gone. You know, he would have wanted to go. You know, and there's those pictures at the time of George playing tennis with Bob Dylan. It's quite funny because George and Bob are hanging around. So, you know, it's kind of business as usual in a way.
It is. And as you say, it's a week in which there are momentous things happening. So you've got the photo shoot that last time they're together, Isle of Wight, Paul becoming a father. Just another week.
So, you know, and we've maybe beaten it to death, this notion of what happened in the months at the end of 1969 and the start of 1970, and the things that could have happened or the things that could have brought them back together. But certainly from August the 23rd, 1969 to today, you know, you could argue this is all the post-Beatles universe, certainly the post-Beatles working universe in a way.
It all starts here.
It all starts.
So can we say that the 23rd of August, it means it's the summation of these three episodes that we should be having some kind of celebration? Or I saw Mark Lewison was designating a day as Beatles Day. Should we be lobbying for the 23rd of August as being Beatles Day?
Well, I think it is reasonably significant, you know, as you know, there are probably maybe some other dates. I'll go back to the drawing board and see, I don't know, February the 17th or something.
Just pick a date.
Just pick a random date. Maybe you could just throw a dart at the dartboard of a calendar and find an interesting Beatles date. But to cut through all of those things, I don't know, were they aware of how time was passing around them when they were living this existence, whether they could actually say when they're getting that photo shoot done, well, you know, it's about a year or two since we were in, Shea Stadium and all the rest.
You just have a sense that they just don't have time to look back.
And possibly August the 23rd, 1969 is when they did kind of take their foot off the gas and start to look around and see what was happening, because, you know, September 69 is the pivotal month.
I bet on the 23rd of August in any year, apart from the year he actually got married, John didn't even think about his anniversary.
What we learned on was that, you know, he was more obsessed with the Remo 4 on the day he got married than with his wife.
Yeah.
But what do you think, everybody? Is August the 23rd a notable day that we should be celebrating year in, year out? Maybe we should look at August the 23rd, the solo years in the future. That's another 7 or 8 episodes right there. But let us know what you think. We are available in all the usual places, at BeatlesPod on Twitter, the Nothing's Real Facebook group, 7,000 odd people and growing strong. The website, www.nothingisrealpod.com, where we have links to old episodes and information about our Acast Plus tier, where we've got many, many, many bonus episodes. And thank you to all our subscribers. And we're always happy to discuss these issues wherever you can find us online. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's still Stephen Corcoran.
Stephen Stills. And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.